Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast. If you're looking for the most in-depth insight into the world of downhill and enduro mountain biking, then this is the podcast for you. Before we get into this week's episode, I want to quickly mention our supporting partners who really are helping keep this podcast going. First up, it's We Are One Composites. And if you've not listened to our previous episode with their founder, Dustin Adams, then check them out and find out more about them. They're a small Canadian brand making top quality carbon wheels and bars right there in Kamloops in Canada. I've got some of their Agent 29er rims and I really love them. They've got a whole new range of wheels available right now. And as a Downtime listener, you can get 15% off any stock Movement or Revolution series wheels or their new de-package bar and stem for the month of July. This is only for stock products, so please no custom tweaks if you want the discount. All you got to do is head to wearonecomposites.com and use the code DOWNTIME15 at the checkout. That's Downtime with a capital D followed by the number 15. Next up is thanks to Komoot. Komoot is a route planning and navigation app that, unlike most of the others, is actually designed to work for mountain biking. You can plan your routes on your phone or on your computer, and all you need to do is to give it a start and an endpoint and it'll plan the best route for you. It then gives you a detailed breakdown of your route, including gradients, surface type, difficulty, that kind of stuff. And then you can use the offline navigation to keep you on track, even if you're out of phone signal. And there's turn-by-turn voice navigation, which means you can focus on enduring your riding and let Komoot take care of the rest. The Komoot app is free to download, and as a Downtime listener, they're offering you a free regional map bundle of your choice worth $8.99. That means you'll be able to take the maps offline and connect your Komoot with your Garmin or your Wahoo device so you can follow the routes on there too. All you need to do is head to komoot.com/G, and that's Komoot, spelled KOMOOT.com/G, and use the code Downtime, which is all in uppercase or one word, at the checkout. That offer is valid until the end of August 2019, so head over to komoot.com and give it a try for free. I also really appreciate the support that I get from all of our listeners. Please keep on helping out by telling your riding friends about the podcast and let them know what they're missing out on if they aren't listening. If you want to support us and help spread the word, show that you're part of a growing group of riders who are listening, learning and getting faster as a result, then head to downtimepodcast.com/shop and check out our t-shirts, hoodies and mugs. Massive thank you to everyone who's already bought something. It all helps to keep the podcast going. As always, don't forget to head to downtimepodcast.com and subscribe to the podcast. Join our newsletter to keep up to date with everything podcast related and give us a follow on social media where we're at Downtime Podcast. Okay, this week I'm sitting down with Rob Weaver and Seb Stott from the Mountain Biking UK Mag test team. We chat about how to get into being a bike tester, which is a dream job for a lot of people, what it takes to test gear properly, and we hear from these guys who spend a lot of time on their bikes, how they go about setting them up. We also discuss some of the latest trends, such as mixed wheel size bikes. All right, without further ado, here's Rob Weaver and Seb Stott. Let's find out a bit about you guys before we kind of talk more about what you're up to these days. So, Rob, let's start with you.
Okay.
Give us a bit of your background and how you got into the sport.
Okay. Well, I guess when I was about 10, I think I was about 10, picked up MBUK for the first time. It's not a deliberate plug. Genuinely picked up MBUK. I think my brother maybe bought the first copy in the house, and then I started getting into it. He got more into BMX and I sort of stuck with the mountain bikes, and then I entered my first cross country race when I was, must have been 11, and then yeah, really got into it. And it was a case of a couple of guys down my road, so Luke Marshall, who actually works on the MUK staff now, staff writer, so him and I and his brother Rob ended up from about the age of 11-12 traveling to pretty much every single race together. We only lived two or three doors apart. I kind of sucked at cross country because I was small and asthmatic. So I still enjoyed it, but it was hard work, especially when you start getting, you know, a little bit older and some of the bigger kids kind of just smoked you by so much.
Yeah.
And there was no way to kind of keep up. So always played in the woods on the bikes, dug jumps and stuff like that. And I guess that's what I really enjoyed. And so when the opportunity came up and we thought, oh, maybe we'll give this sort of emerging downhill racing a go, I didn't do great my first race, but I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed it more than the cross country. And I think it sort of went from there. So yeah, every weekend it was either going to ride downhill or trying to get to the races.
Yeah.
And we sort of progressed through the regional stuff. So back then it would have been Sam's. And then from the SAMs to the national stuff. And then alongside nationals, we did Dragons, which I think was probably the steepest learning curve for a lot of people.
And
at
the steepest tracks, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Really hard tracks, fairly, compared to now, fairly basic bikes.
Right.
So it was a lot about just trying to deal with stuff that you've never ridden before in your life with, you know, I think I had the first Dragon I did, I think I would have had Magura brakes on, so rim brakes. And it was the case of, you know, you're worrying about keeping your wheels turning because they would clog up with mud, things like that, you know. And from there, just plugged away at the racing, but still enjoyed my riding.
Did you do some World Cup downhill?
I only did a year of it. I wouldn't say I was racing them because I never qualified.
You showed up.
I was there, making everyone else feel much better about themselves.
What was that like, though? Like coming from, you know, a fairly grassroots sort of early days of downhill in the UK, taking it all the way to that top level at Downhill World Cup?
Well, I would never say I was at the level. I think I was at my depth,
right?
If I'm honest. It was really hard. And I feel like I was quite bad at racing. I was okay at practice.
Okay. So what was missing then? What wasn't there in your toolbox?
I think I'm a natural worrier, so I'd overthink everything. And as a result, I would just sort of crumble as soon as I heard the beeps and I'd be all over the shop. So it was an amazing experience and I love being at the races.
Yeah.
I rode on a little team that started up. It was called the Gumball 3000 team. So it was to do with the, you know, the big race,
the car rally
race thing. Yeah. It was really good fun and it was a great experience. And, you know, I've been really lucky to get to travel some cool places with my friends essentially and just go and race. Well, not race, but try and qualify.
Wicked.
I really struggled with it. And I think, looking back, most of us never took it serious enough. And so it was like, well, you know, we ride downhill 2-3 times a month. That'll be fine.
Yeah.
That'll be enough.
And the scene was less serious then anyway. Right?
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. But it was heaps of fun. Yeah. We had a really good time, really good laugh traveling. And,
nice.
And then I guess from there, well, even before that, I'd already had my hand in with doing some freelance stuff. We actually rode on, it was part of the Saracen team. And part of that was to shoot the catalogue for them. And that's how I met Steve Baer. So that would have been 2000, 2001, I think it was. So Luke and I went and shot the Saracen catalogue that year, did some stuff with Steve. And then Steve sort of said, oh, you should come along, get involved, come on some bike test shoots. And I did, and I got to know the guys in the office more, and then ended up writing some feature stuff for them. And then at the end of the 2006 season, when I was racing a bit more seriously, they asked if I wanted to do a bit of testing. And so it, end of 2006, 2007, I started doing some test stuff. Then I disappeared to Australia for a bit. Did a bit of work for a magazine down there. Came back, did some more freelance stuff, and then ended up in the office nearly 10 years ago.
Okay. And because your background, is it sports technology? Is that your degree?
Yeah. So that's the degree I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a science-based degree with lots of engineering, a bit of biomechanics and stuff like that.
Okay. So pretty perfect match
Elements definitely lend itself. You have, I think, a fairly broad understanding of, you know, how you as a human interact with bike and, you know, how, I guess, to a degree, you can improve that by changing this, that, the other. So, and I guess for me, there was always parts of that I would be thinking about. And I was always pretty picky with setup and stuff like that. So testing was sort of an extension of that to a degree. It was something I really enjoyed. I genuinely enjoyed finding out back then, like Nico and Fabian and those guys, hearing about what they would do to make their life easier riding the bikes. Uh-huh. And I was thinking, well, I'm not really that quick. So maybe if I can do this, maybe if I change tires or, you know, anything I can do to get some kind of mechanical advantage that means that, you know, my poorer skill set is kind of bolstered a little bit by that and make my life easier.
Yeah.
Was always a real positive for me and something I really enjoyed finding out about. And then, yeah, I've been really lucky that since working with the mag, it's something I get to do on a sort of day-to-day basis, find out about all sorts of different products and different companies and how they approach, you know, R&D and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's a cool job. Really cool. Yeah. And MBUK was quite a different magazine when you started, right? Maybe a younger audience and a different style. Tell us about some of the, you did some pretty interesting articles early doors.
So I think the first commission feature I was paid to write was bikes versus skiers. So it was me and two of the guys from the Mad, remember the Saracen Mad team?
Yeah.
So one guy was a trials rider, one guy was a dirt jumper, and we got a bunch of cash, a hire van, a load of bikes from Saracen, and we got told to drive down to Team, where we met some incredibly talented skiers. I think one guy was like, he was some guy, he was sponsored by Red Bull at the time, which was quite rare back then, and he was some international, you know, skiing free ride legend. And the idea was that we would kind of come up with these different challenges and pit bikes against the skis, which was, you know, a bit of a joke, really.
Set up to fail.
Yeah, pretty much. I think you know, we got stopped by the police because we sort of dug a jump and used all this cladding that we'd found to make a roll in over an avalanche barrier that dropped over a road. And the police stopped us doing that. And then when we went to the ballpark, that's when you start to realize just how out of depth you are. And just, those guys are so good. And you try following someone on skis into a big jump, and then you realize, like, whoa, someone's going to die in a minute.
Yeah.
And it was ridiculous. But then I guess, the point being that, yeah, it used to be quite different. And there used to be stuff like pantomimes in the mag and stuff like that. And that's no bad thing, because I think it did its job really well at the time. But just like the scene and everything involved, it's grown up. And, and the magazine, we've gone from, I think when I started doing that stuff, the average age of the reader was probably like 18 to 21 maybe. In our last reader survey, average age is 40.
Okay.
Most readers have two bikes, a kid, you know, that sort of stuff. So properly grown up with the magazine, grown up with the scene. So that's what we've tried to do in the mag, to try and reflect that.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's hard to, because it's so broad, it's hard to cater to everyone's tastes. But I think generally if people have kind of left the mag for a while, maybe stopped mountain biking for whatever reasons, for work, for family pressures, and then they've gone, oh, you know what, I've got a bit of spare cash, I might get the cycle to work scheme on the go and buy a new bike. Maybe they'll pick up MBUK, and generally we get a really positive response, and maybe, you know, the odd emails just saying, oh wow, you know, I haven't read it in 15 years and I can't believe how many changes you made, and it's so nice that it's still around.
Yeah,
because, you know, we celebrated 30 years, was it last year? So, you know, it's
been going a long time.
Yeah, it has.
It's the same for me. I had a big gap from it. I used to read it all the time when I was a kid, cover to cover, multiple times.
Yeah.
And I had a good old gap from it through, you know, not having much money as a student or whatever, not spending on magazines. And then you sort of forget about that part. And
yeah,
I've picked it up again fairly recently, and it's very different to what it was.
Yeah. And I guess for us, you know, we're from the same generation, in that it was a really good way into it.
Yeah.
And there was loads of insights, and it was that sort of gateway into seeing what the pros do and that interaction and a bit of the racing. Obviously, we don't really cover racing anymore because the internet's instantaneous. You know? So if people want race results, they're not going to wait a month to buy a mag.
Yeah.
And for us, obviously, dirt came in, which was the new cool thing at the time, and it was really good. And yeah, you know, I switched from MBUK and was reading dirt for a long time, and yeah, it was nice then, but it was really cool to get back involved. And
yeah,
at that point, Tim was still at the helm, Tim Manley, who's a really larger than life sort of crazy guy and really outspoken and absolutely hilarious. And he was brilliant to work alongside and be part with. So yeah, it's, it's evolved a lot over the years.
Yeah.
But I think it's in a good place now.
Cool.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Thanks. Let's find out a bit about you then, Seb. Tell us, you're a little bit younger. Tell us a little bit about your kind of background and how you got into riding and then how you've ended up working at MBUK.
It's kind of similar to what you were saying about how you started, and I guess how a lot of people started. I just took whatever bike I had, some rigid mountain bike, and went down the local hill and thought, this is absolutely amazing fun to ride a bike down tracks that are, it's totally not designed for. And then there was quite a, I was really lucky to live up in Aberdeenshire, where there was a big, big local scene for riding on the local hill, which is called Scalty Hill, and there still is. So yeah, I got into that with some mates and saved up for ages for a bike, and bought a 24/7 dirt jump bike.
Nice.
Did some dirt jumping and then took it down the downhill tracks as well, and then eventually got myself a downhill bike and started racing some SDAs, the Scottish Downhill Series. Raced a handful of those, crashed in most of them, but got some half-decent results in the ones I didn't crash. And then I went to uni, and I kind of got into kind of trail bikes. Had my first full suspension bike that you could actually pedal uphill, which was quite a revelation.
Yeah.
quite a thing.
What did you study at uni?
I studied experimental physics.
Go on, explain what that is.
So it's basically physics, but we're not nerdy enough to do the theoretical stuff.
You do the fun bit.
Kind of get to do experiments and play about with things. I actually was going to, I always thought I would study mechanical engineering. And then I did a work experience placement just before I was applying to universities. And I was like, I'm not sure I want to sit in an office and drive CAD all day long.
Yeah.
So I kind of got cold feet about that idea and sort of thought, well, I'll study physics because then it keeps my options way more open. And then 4 years later, after I'd finished uni, I was absolutely none the wiser about what I wanted to do the rest of my life. So, but pretty much at the time I graduated, or just before this job came up, I was shared on a local Facebook group by Tom Marvin, who also works here. And yeah, I applied for that, got it, and yeah, never looked back. Never really had to think hard about what to do after uni.
So that's your first job out of uni?
Yeah. That's really cool. Very much on my feet.
Yeah. How long have you been at the Mag now?
Just over 4 years.
Okay.
Yeah, 4 years
in January. And always in the test side?
Yeah, I've had the same job the whole time I've been here.
So
yeah.
Do you work for Rob? Is he the boss?
Technically. he's my boss, yeah.
Wicked. Cool. So you guys, obviously, you're running the test team at MBUK.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit, I don't know who wants to take this, but maybe share it between you somehow. Like, how do you approach testing product? Because it's, I guess a lot of people just assume you get some shiny new thing, chuck it on your bike, go ride, but there's more thought that goes into it.
Sure. Yeah. And I guess sort of, I guess we should probably clear up. It makes it sound like it's a really big team for testing. But so yeah, what the team that Seb and I are part of works across. So we work across all the cycling titles that Immediate Media own.
Okay.
So Cycling Plus and Bike Radar.
Yeah.
So there's a group of us that, while predominantly most of my work is fairly sort of MBUK focused, Seb's workload's probably split across Bike Radar.
50-50-ish.
And Tom, who's a tech head on Bike Radar, pure, you know, just Bike Radar really, and he occasionally dips into the MBUK bits and pieces. But yeah, okay. So it's actually a small team, and we have to produce quite a lot of content when you think about how much goes into each magazine, Road and Mountain, as well as on the
website.
On the web as well, yeah. So, but yeah, sorry, back to your question. With regards to how you test something, I guess big thing for us is the due diligence, so making sure everything's as consistent and fair as possible. Making sure that, you know, if we think we've come across some kind of anomaly, if maybe like a shock tune isn't right, if we don't think something's necessarily right with the fork, we'll generally try and reach out to those manufacturers and go, hey, you know, we kind of noticed this. And if they say, hold on, you know, that's totally wrong, or it shouldn't have done this, it shouldn't have done that, then maybe they'll send another product or say, you'll try this, or sorry, maybe we sent you something with the wrong tune, try that again. And we'll always try and take that into account. And sometimes the outcome may not have changed at all. It might be that something is that way and it's designed to be that way and it's wrong.
Okay.
And that's the review.
Yeah.
And it'll be, you know, more of a negative review.
Yeah. Yeah, or wrong in our opinion, at least.
You know, wrong. Yeah,
there's sorry, certain things that aren't exactly wrong, but that the brand says this is how it's designed to work, and we say, well, I think it doesn't work as well as it could. So, for example, there's those wheels that I tested that, you know, they broke. Okay, didn't just go straight on the internet and say, oh, these wheels break all the time, because you can break anything.
Yeah.
But, you know, got another set in. They broke as well. Got a third set in. They broke as well. You know, there was the pre-production line about the first wheels. So it was like, okay, benefit of that, fair enough. But then, you know, you test more and you compare it to other products and you ride on trails that you know really well. I think that's the key for me. Mm. Like when you tell people that you test bikes for a living or something along those lines, people think, oh, wow, that's amazing. And it is. It's a dream job. But it's not just going out and riding a bike with your mates. It's riding the same track over and over again. You know, there's tracks around here and at Bike Park Wales that I've probably ridden dozens of times, you know.
Probably more than that.
Probably more than that. Getting on for 100 runs, I reckon, of 50 shades.
I think a big indicator is when one of your mates maybe has a day off and they go, oh, we'll come riding. And you're like, okay, but I've got to do this. And then they realise that you are just going to lap the same track over and over again.
Yeah.
And it might be that you then have to be working out the back of the van, changing forks, changing wheels, all these sort of time-consuming, faffy things. And then they don't want to come again.
Yeah. But I love it in its own way. It's totally different experience to just going for a ride where you're thinking about yourself and you're thinking about, you know, oh, can I cut that corner? Can I take the high line around there? Can I push a bit harder, brake a bit later? And when you're out testing, you're not thinking about any of that. You're just trying to ride the same lines, same braking points, all that stuff.
It's a fascinating
on a track process that you've ridden 100 times.
Yeah.
And then, but you're looking at the stuff, the bike, maybe you're changing forks, maybe you're changing bikes, maybe you're changing tires. And to feel the difference and to really come away and be like, yeah, I could feel the difference. It was doing this, whereas the other setup, it wasn't. That's really fascinating to me, and it's a different type of enjoyment to just going out for a ride.
Yeah. Do you think you have to be a good rider to be a good tester?
I think it's a certain level. I think you've got to be able to push things reasonably hard.
Yeah. I don't think you necessarily need to be, I don't know, World Cup level to, you know, and test a downhill bike, because I still think you can garner quite a lot if you've got a good knowledge around what you think a downhill bike should be and how it should perform.
Mm-hmm.
I think everyone's opinion's valid. Everyone has input, right?
If it's
a 500 quid bike designed for beginners and a beginner rides it and says, oh, this feels kind of funny, this feels sort of funny, it's going to be drastically different to more experienced, you know, tester, but it's just as relevant. And I think that's, we're lucky in the sense that we've got a really good group of people. And then if something does crop up where we're kind of scratching our head a little bit and wondering, I can't quite put my finger on it, it might be that one of the other guys has ridden the bike or something similar, and they might have some feedback. Or we're just, if we can ride the same size bikes, switch people, switch testers, just to try and add a bit more depth to what we're doing.
Okay.
We do that sort of thing a lot when we're doing Bike of the Year.
Yeah. So you get multiple points of view on the same thing.
Yeah. And you know, even some years we've done developed feedback sheets. So it's where you can have an even broader range of people because you're narrowing down the field that you're looking at. So it gets quite complicated, but you might, of those, you know, if you've got 5-10 people looking at those different bikes, certain people might pick up on things that you completely overlooked. And it's really fascinating. And it adds to the whole thing. It just means everything just takes a bit longer.
Yeah.
Which is why the process, why you've got to be so good at driving spreadsheets and planning and stuff like that.
Yeah. So how do you deal with that? Like, it's very easy to test it for you.
Yeah.
But you're both pretty quick. You're both very experienced riders. You get a lot of ride hours. You've tried loads of different stuff. How do you sort of put yourself in your reader's position, I guess? Like, how do you deal with, like, reviewing something for someone who maybe is riding once a week and has only been riding 2 years and hasn't tried every single new fork on the market? And how do you deal with that?
That's a good question. I kind of think that to a large extent, what works well for riding at a certain level will work well for riding below that level. Maybe not so much riding above that level.
Okay.
I think people often say things like, is that bike holding you back, or is it limited? As if the bike was a kind of had an upper limit of how it was able to ride, in the same way that a car is closer to having that kind of upper limit.
Yeah.
I think bikes aren't like that at all. I think that the bike and the rider interact in a way that allows the rider to ride at a certain speed or with a certain amount of confidence.
Yeah.
And I think that it's not so much about finding the limit of the bike, because, you know, someone who's really fast could ride any of my test bikes much faster than I could ride any of my other test bikes. But I know that I can ride much faster on one bike than another, or I can have more fun, feel more confident, hit those high lines that I wouldn't hit on the other bike. And I think it's not universal. Like, what worked for me won't necessarily work for someone else. But I think there's a certain amount that you can say about a bike which will translate to other people. What am I trying to say?
I guess you're sort of putting enough information on the page to give people a context in which to make a decision if it works for them or not. Like, is that how you approach writing it up, or rather than just saying it's good or it's bad?
Well, I think you need to look at stuff like the price, what the product's intended for, what's its nearest competitors, and we're in a fortunate position where a lot of the stuff we'll do, we'll be able to pull, you know, 2, 3, 4 of those similar things together at once, and we're able to then back-to-back those things. And I think if there's certain things, I guess the cheaper end's really interesting because it's got so good now, where it used to just be these standout things where you know, if it was like the £500 hardtails, it was pretty much anything that had, if one of those came with an air sprung fork, for example, that you could tune and you could adjust the rebound, that was a massive win, rather than it being a fixed spring rate coil sprung fork that topped out like crazy, had, you know, V brakes, whatever it might be. We've moved so far from that, but I guess the back-to-back thing's key, really crucial, and we've ridden a lot of bikes, so we've got lots of points of reference. And if you've ridden that number of bikes, that number of products, if something that, I don't know, whoever it might be, is pitching this fork at this price point and it's doing something that isn't quite right compared to the competitors, which is at the same price point and feels really good, then that's the sort of thing I hope we can pick up on.
Yeah.
And then give essentially buying advice to the readers to point me in the right direction.
Cool. And how much of what you do in a testing environment is data driven versus feel? Because data is, other than kind of time, and even that's not easy to measure accurately. How do you deal with that kind of balance between qualitative and quantitative?
I think we'll quantify everything that we reasonably can. So we're talking earlier about measuring travel, measuring head angles, because they're not what they say on the geometry chart very often. Measuring all sorts of things, reach, wheelbase, bottom bracket height, seat angles, all those things. And then you can measure it your way consistently, that in a way that translates to all the bikes. Seat angle is a really good example, actually, because some manufacturers will measure the seat angle at a different point, at a different height.
Okay.
Whereas what I'll do is I'll set all the bikes to my seat height, so it's consistent, and then measure the actual seat angle, sorry, the effective seat angle, from BB to top of the seat tube, and then it's consistent along all the bikes. So we'll kind of measure all the things that we can. And then timing is an interesting one. I don't always time. In fact, I'd say more often than not, I don't, because it's so hard to be so consistent that a time means anything.
Yeah.
You can just try a bit harder or, you know, have learned the conditions on the day a bit better. You have to be, if you're going to do timing and read something into it, you need to be so careful about knowing the track, not just generally, but on the day, doing back-to-back tests with different setups of different bikes, and then going back again. Because if you do an A to B comparison, you're always going to feel better on the second time.
Yeah, yeah. You need to go back to A.
Bookend it, yeah.
And then if you go A, B, A, that's better.
Yeah.
But if you can do A, B, A, B, A, B, that's best. And then you can start to look at the times.
Yeah.
But to do that is so difficult that I rarely do it. But what I do sometimes do is use a timer as a point of reference to kind of calibrate what I can feel.
Yeah.
So, for example, I was testing a couple of bikes the other day where I was like, oh, on this bike, I feel like it's a bit calmer. I feel like I can look further down the trail. But then I looked at the times and I was just going really slow. I was going way slower on that bike because it was so heavily damped.
Yeah.
It was just sucking out speed on the rough sections. So that's why it felt easier, because and then I could look at the times and go, oh, that's probably why. And there's a very big difference between something that feels fast and is fast.
Yeah.
And that's very interesting to compare against the times, even if you're not going to publish the times and be like, oh, this bike is faster. But you can calibrate against how the bike feels by going, okay, well, they were the same sort of time, but I felt this.
Yeah.
Or I think they felt the same, but one was way faster. That's where it becomes really useful.
Yeah, and I've definitely found it before where I can put a good time in on a run where maybe I felt like everything was going quite well, and then you ride a bike and your feet are blown off, and then you look at the stopwatch at the end, and you're like, oh, right, actually, yeah, like half a second. Okay, so maybe there's something in the bike, or maybe, you know, maybe there's something else I need to explore.
Okay.
And some bikes I found where, like Seb said, you know, we don't publish the time stuff. It's just a point of reference.
Unless we're going to do it really properly.
Yeah. Unless it's going to be this sort of super thorough thing. But it's quite, for me, I quite like doing it, as we said, as just as a reference almost. And I've had bikes where I've felt like I've had to work really hard, but you know that they're fast.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, whether it's damping, whether something's too stiff and awkward, you fatigue quite quick. So while you might be able to put one good run in, you then go, oh, how repeatable is it? And especially important for something like Enduro, mm-hmm. where, you know, you don't want to be rattled senseless with every run, because it's not like downhill where you can just, you know, muscle through because it's just a few minutes.
Yeah.
It's that sort of repeatable thing over the course of a day, over a weekend. So, I guess it just adds another interesting element to consider.
Yeah. So you've got to be quite fit to be a tester as well, if you're back to back and stuff, and try not to let fatigue get in.
I guess it helps. You know, you've got to be aware that you're going to fatigue over the day at the very least. And yeah, I guess we do get a lot of saddle time, and that definitely helps.
It's a big perk as well.
yeah. It's nice.
You get to ride a lot.
It's an upside.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So how long would you spend testing a particular product? Does it vary a lot depending on what it is?
Varies massively, yeah.
Maybe give some extremes, like something that you can test really quickly and something that you'd spend a lot of time on.
Well, you can make your life easier. You can do stuff like if you're doing gloves or shoes, you can wear different gloves on different hands.
Nice.
Different shoes on different feet.
Yeah.
That also means you can compare them directly now.
You're essentially getting a direct head-to-head.
That would mess with my OCD.
Head-to-head feedback.
I couldn't Australia, do it.
Just don't lay down.
I'd crash.
You just can't lay down. But I guess that helps in terms of efficiency. You might look a bit of a weirdo out on the trail.
Yeah.
But it's a really easy way to do stuff fairly quickly. Uh-huh. Obviously, all the, you know, the big question marks then hang over durability, but the idea being that we sort of build a backlog of products, and this stuff doesn't really change too much over the air. Obviously, it's hard when new stuff's introduced, but if we know we've ridden Model X shoe for the last year or so and they've just brought it out in a different colour and, you know, it's been reintroduced and we're covering it in the group chest, we know that it already holds up perfectly well. It lets in this much water and it's, you know, a bit sweaty, for example. Yeah. So that's quite good. Just building that back catalogue of stuff makes stuff quicker to get through.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the extreme stuff is when you talk about forks, shocks. That's where it gets way more time consuming and complicated.
And then like setup becomes so important. When you're testing bikes or when you're testing something like a fork, if it's doing a particular behavior that you don't like, maybe it's harsh, maybe it's bouncing you offline, maybe it's lacking support, you have to first try and fix that as best you can. And that takes a lot of time. You've got to, you know, you can't just say, oh, this fork's rubbish, it's not holding me up. You know, you've got, right, okay, what if you change the spring rate? What if you change the volume spaces? What if you change the compression? If you can change the rebound? So it becomes a right headache doing that.
So you get pretty good at setting bikes up.
Yeah, like we were talking about earlier, I have quite a consistent method of setting up test bikes. And then for me, it's kind of about going from that starting point and then trying to get the most out of the bike, trying to make it work for me. So the bike I was testing at the moment, just that Orbea Rallon, just doesn't have enough, the handlebars aren't high enough for me.
Right.
The steerer is too short. So I've put on a 40mm rise bar. Sometimes I'll put on a different stem length. I'm not going to like put on a new fork because that's unrealistic. But if I was buying that bike and the stem is too long, I'm going to buy a new stem.
Yeah, you're going to tweak it.
And adjusting things like tire pressure and suspension settings to get the most out of it within reason, cool. Which is kind of personal, but to make it work as well as it can for me.
Yeah, and you've done some really good videos actually on your setup process, so we'll put some links in the show notes so people can find those because they're definitely a good guide into how to set suspension up, well explained. So yeah, people will love that. We'll stick them in the show notes.
Thank you very much.
He knows what he's talking about.
It's a physics thing, isn't it? He's on it. So I was going to ask, like, what are some of the hardest things to test? So obviously suspension related stuff where there's a lot of setup. Are there other products that are either kind of hard to differentiate or particularly challenging to test?
Going back to what we were talking about earlier, I think the hardest thing for us is talking about reliability.
Right.
Because most often we have a sample of one.
Yes.
You know, we have one dropper post. If we're doing a dropper post group test, we'll have one of each and we'll be able to compare things like return speed, stack height, weight, offset, all those things. But what people really want to know with a dropper post is if I run it for 6 months, will it break?
Yeah.
And we have a massive, we have in our office, there's 10 people who ride mountain bikes, something like that.
Yeah.
People who ride lots of different bikes. We have on MBK, there's long-term bikes.
Yeah.
We're getting long-term bikes and bike radar as well, so we can test things longer term. So we can start to kind of build up a little bit more data and be able to say things a bit more consistently. But the hardest thing is, usually when you have a product on test, it either breaks or it doesn't. And either way, it's a sample of one, so you don't know if that's a really common problem or if it's 1 in 1,000. But, you know, just by having, and nowadays we do this thing increasingly where every time we test something, we send out an email and be like, have you had this problem with this product? You know, we've got, there's probably 10 people on that email list, maybe more, people who have tested all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
So we almost always have someone else who's in the office who's had that product before.
Okay, so you can increase your sample size a little bit.
And I think what's interesting and what I guess a lot of people don't realize is that across the different magazines in the UK especially, we're all actually really good mates. Okay. So it might be that another magazine has tried a different bike and that we've just got it and gone like, oh, hold on, it's doing something kind of quirky. Pick up the phone to one of the guys at MBR, maybe the guys at Single Track, and go, oh, have you experienced this? Did it do this with you? What do you think about that? And we're all, everyone's really open.
Nice.
And we're all really good friends. So we share that sort of info between us.
That's cool.
And that always seems to work really well, I think. And then we've got, you know, in the past we've had Steve Warland, who, you know, passed away a few years ago. He was just this fountain of knowledge. He just knew everything. And he knew everyone. So if, yeah, he really helped me when I first started, because he was the first guy that commissioned me for a bike test when I was a freelancer. And any problems, he would just guide you to the right person. And because he'd done it from, you know, day one, when the magazine started, more or less, he just knew the people right at the top. And you end up speaking to the most senior engineer and you go, I'm feeling this. Is that about right? And they were like, oh, yeah, actually, yeah, it's funny you point that out. Oh, okay, great, we're on to something. And then same for Guy, you know, Guy Kesterman, absolute legend and, you know, really good friend of mine. And he's got, what, 20, 22 years testing experience. So, you know, it'd be hard to name a bike that he hasn't ridden and tested, which is insane. That's
saying something, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, he's got this encyclopedic knowledge of just about everything, how it's made, what it's made from, who put it together, you know, that sort of thing. And being able to draw upon that experience when we can is, yeah, it's invaluable. So it makes a massive difference to our lives, yeah.
Awesome. One of the things that I hear people say quite a lot is that you never see a bad review. And I personally don't totally agree with that, but a lot of reviews are quite favourable across the board. I guess that's because there's a lot of good products out these days. But how do you guys approach that? If you get something that you're not overly impressed with, obviously if there's an issue, like you said, you'll speak to the brand and try and work out whether it's a problem or whether you guys just don't like it. But how do you deal with giving a bad review, and what are the brands generally like with that sort of stuff?
I think kind of going back to what we said earlier, you know, we try and make sure we do our due diligence, so we make sure we pick up on any of those things and feedback as and when necessary to make sure we get the complete picture when we're testing something. Ask all the relevant questions to the right people. And if we're maybe worried about something that we're feeling, give it to another tester, see what they come back with. And then maybe it's something that someone's overlooked, a setup issue or something like that. And if at the end of the day, we need to write a bad review, then that's what we'll do. And I think we'll only ever do that. We'll do that, but knowing full well that we've done all, we've followed that process, that protocol as strictly as we possibly can.
Yeah.
So we know when that manufacturer, that brand will come back to us and say, hey, that's a terrible review. We're really not happy. But we can make sure we can feedback going, okay, so we tried this, 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 we know this, you said this, we've got the back catalogue of emails, of the correspondence. We know that we've done everything we can to make sure we've done it as well as we possibly can.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you look in the mag, you'll find plenty of negative reviews. I think that's partly because we test things comparatively as much as possible, and not everything can be great. So, you know, if you do a group test of 10 products or 15 products, they're not all going to get 4 or 5 stars. Otherwise, it's pointless.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we do negative reviews, and there's a lot of due diligence involved with that. You know, you've got to be really careful that you don't basically upset a brand for something that's not true.
Right.
You don't want to do that, but equally, you don't want to recommend a product that might cost several thousand pounds to, you know, we've got tens of thousands of readers of MBUK and Bike Radar on top of that. You don't want to recommend to all those people buy these wheels when they're no good.
Yeah.
That's just as important to be careful with as a negative review.
Yeah. So I guess your lives are a little bit harder because of that, because you have to do all that background, the due diligence, the contact with the brands, that kind of stuff. So you create more work doing that, but it enables you to give a fairer review to the list, to the readers.
I think so. And I think the brands respect it, and I think they'll send that awkward email and say, you know, we're really not happy with this. Can you provide us with XYZ to justify what you've done?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we've gone and done, like I said, if we followed that process, that procedure, and we're able to come back with some really solid feedback, for the most part, they'll go, okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
You know, there's always going to be times when we royally, you know, pee someone off.
Yeah.
But for the most part, yeah, it's respected more than anything, I think.
That's good.
I hope, anyway.
Yeah, that's good to hear. So yeah. What's blown you away then in the last 12 months? What have you ridden, tried, tested that you've just been like, wow, this is special. This takes things to the next level, or it's the thing I've been waiting for. What would be your pick out of the last sort of 12 or so months?
It's hard to say. Probably the product I've recommended to people to go out and buy from actual mates is a glove.
Go on. So
there's a 100% Briscoe glove, which is pretty cheap, and it's just so good.
It's
one of the only winter glove I've tested that just feels every bit as good as any other summer glove.
Yeah, you don't notice any difference in the palm.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's really tactile feel on the grips. And they're really cheap, so you can, you're always like, go and buy those.
Yeah, like £20, aren't they?
Yeah, like you want a grip for riding, a glove for riding in fairly cold weather. Yeah, those ones.
Yeah, I had them on today, they were perfect.
Yeah.
And I think we do spend so much time out in the, because, you know, bike of the year pretty much straddles Christmas, so it's really the worst possible month of the year. Mm. So you're out, you know, trying to avoid getting trench foot and stuff like that. And a big thing for me was just switching to wearing riding trousers.
Okay.
Proper trousers to ride in.
Yeah.
Sounds like a really silly little thing, but getting the right jacket and the right, you know, the right equipment makes life when you're outside all day so much more comfortable and so much more bearable.
Yeah.
Just being able to peel everything off at the end, not being having your legs caked in mud, your pads caked in mud. It's quicker and just way, way more comfortable.
Yeah. What's your go-to riding trouser? Is there one that you like always pick?
The Specialized Demo.
Okay.
I think it's the Demo Pants, I think they're called. They're really hard to get hold of.
Right.
And they always seem to come back in stock at the start of summer. So it's really awkward. But yeah, there's those. The new Fox Defend ones are good. Enduro have got some good ones.
There's loads now, isn't there? Like a tighter fitting, like less lighter weight. Yeah. But
Ion has got some good ones. Ion have got some really good ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, the fashion has changed maybe because the downhills are doing it. And the downhills are doing it because it's more aerodynamic.
Yeah.
And it's made it cool to wear trousers. And you go out and wear them on your trail bike in the winter. And you're like, oh, I don't have to clean my legs before I can get in the car. I'm not getting like dried on mud as I drive home. I'm caked on legs. So, yeah.
Win-win.
Yeah, they are pretty good.
Thanks to the downhill boys then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, well, let's talk a bit about some of the key trends in the industry, because you guys have the luxury, depending on how you look at it, of trying, you know, virtually everything out there. I don't know if you've had a chance to play around with this much yet, but there's a lot of talk, obviously, this year about 29-inch front wheels and 27.5 rear wheels. Have either of you had a play on it yet?
I haven't yet.
Okay.
Something I'm going to try on my bike.
Yeah.
I've ridden it on Chris Porter's bike, actually.
Okay.
But there was a lot of other things that were odd about that bike that totally buried. I'm not convinced of the physics of what people say about like how the bike rolls and leans into the corner nicer. I think really if you can fit a 29-inch back wheel in without it buzzing on your bum, then probably I would say you should do that.
Yeah.
But I think it's probably better than running 27.5 both front and rear for racing, but whether it's better than running 29 front and rear is, I'm highly skeptical of.
Interesting.
Unless you physically can't fit your bum over a 29-inch rear wheel, or if your like frame sponsor doesn't make a 29er frame, for example, then it might be a really good move.
Okay. So do you think we'll see some of the shorter World Cup riders on mixed wheel size?
Possibly, yeah. If they can get the bar height low enough.
Okay.
Because bar height is probably one of the most overlooked and critical aspects of setup.
Come on, tell us more.
If you can get your bar height in the right place, you should forget it.
And how do you know if your bar height's right?
That's a really good question. You've got to experiment.
Okay.
So you've got to buy a bike where the brand has left you enough steerer tube spaces, because they are the most important adjuster on the bike, in my opinion.
Okay.
And play around with them. I think I was guilty of it back in the day. I used to there was a fashion for about 2 years in the downhill scene of slamming the front end. And I was like, oh, that looks really cool. I'm going to do that. But nowadays, I look back, such an idiot, because it ruins how you can ride the bike, especially if you're tall and you've got long legs. You can't push the front end into turn. You can't weight the front wheel and pump it through holes. And you have to run the fork harder to keep the bar height where you need it. So if you run the bar height higher, you can run the fork softer, so it's more comfortable and you have more grip without it feeling like it's diving away from underneath you.
So what sort of stuff are we looking for? So we're going out and we're playing around with bar height. What kind of things should we be cognizant of while we're doing that to understand when we find the optimum?
So if it's too low, you'll be hyperextending your arms and straightening your elbows until your forearm and upper arm is in a straight line.
Okay.
You don't want to do that.
So you'll really fatigue your arms. You'll be really tired. Yeah, trying to do like a steep trail, ride a steep trail will absolutely ruin in your arms.
A higher bar will also make it easier. If you're struggling to lift the front wheel in manual, a higher bar will allow you to lift the bike up much more easily, which especially with longer bikes and longer chainstays, having a higher bar just makes it so much easier to move the bike around. And then on the other end of the scale, if it's too high, you just feel too disconnected from the front wheel. Your hands are physically too far away from the contact patch, and you feel the bike feels vague and just kind of disconnected, and it doesn't feel nice, especially on flat turns.
Yeah,
you can understeer and you can't weight it properly.
Yeah, and you don't feel committed it puts you in a less committed riding position.
Okay. And then if you think of your feet versus your hand position, if you go too high, it's like you're riding a Segway. You know, you're right up high, just kind of scooting around, and you're not really attacking anything and getting your weight forward, which is critical.
And you can't just say this is the right bar height for your height, because it depends on bottom bracket height, obviously. So it's about the difference, but it also depends on reach.
Okay.
So if you have a longer reach, you actually need a taller stack as well.
Yeah.
I think if you ride a tall bar height on a short reach bike, it feels like a Segway. That's a good analogy. And you feel too off the back. Whereas if you ride a low bar height on a bike with a lot of reach, you feel forced over the front. You can't lift the front wheel. It's dragging you down the hill.
Okay.
So I think possibly the angle between the bottom bracket and the grips has to remain similar, although I'm not 100% sure on that. But generally, the longer the reach you have, the more stack you need. And that's a trend we've noticed. I think the main reason people were running short bar heights back in the day was because the bikes were too short.
Yeah.
And now that we have longer bikes, longer reach, if you look at like Menard's V10, for example, he's got 29er fork. He's one of the first to do that with the Syndicate team. And people were like, well, if you have a 200 mil travel fork or 190 or whatever it was with a 29-inch wheel, will you be able to get the bar height the same? And he's still using a big stack of spacers, big like 35 rise bar or whatever it is, because he's got a lot of reach and the angle is probably similar than it is on someone a shorter rider with a shorter stack, a shorter reach.
Cool. So that's something for people to go out and have a play with then. Mm.
Some brands, YT in particular, sometimes cut the steerer so short that you've got almost no adjustment.
Right.
Which is such an open goal on the adjustability of the bike.
Yeah.
It would be like having a fork that, like we were saying earlier, you can't adjust the spring rate. It's that fundamental.
Okay. And if you're buying a new fork, leave plenty of steerer until you've worked it out and then trim it.
Yeah, I know it looks cool to trim it down and save those 10 grams, but if you can adjust the bar height, it's really good.
All right. And what are there any sort of gaps? Are there any products that you spend so much time on a bike that you think, oh, I wish someone made something that did this for me or was a better version of that? Is there anything out there that you're like, wish someone would make that?
If I had any good ideas, I
wouldn't. you'd have done it.
Seems mental that we're still aligning bars by eye.
Okay.
Because I spend about 10 minutes in the car park going, oh no, that's slightly off, no. And then you get out on the trail and you're like, no, this isn't right, stop. Adjust it slightly.
Someone's made a self-aligning
stem. People are starting to do it.
Mm. Yeah.
People are starting to do it.
Yeah. Isn't there like that laser guided thing you can use?
Yeah, I've seen that. It's like a tool.
Yeah.
That's an expensive fix for a simple problem, though, isn't it? But anyway.
Yes. It is,
yeah. It's a bar
alignment. Maybe it wouldn't be such a problem if I just left my bar height alone and just put up with it. But if you're adjusting those things all the time and setting up different bikes all the time, then it's a real pain.
Yeah. What about you, Rob? Is there anything that you're missing?
Any gaps?
Hmm.
Yeah, that is a good question.
14 speed.
Yeah, 14, 15 speed for my little legs. Keep them spinning around. I don't know, really. I think there's a lot of good stuff out there right now. And I guess, especially with the likes of Kickstarter and all those things, there's almost extra things that maybe we don't need kicking around.
Yeah.
I won't say anything in particular, but we get, obviously, like in our position, you can imagine people send us stuff going, oh, can you stick this online, can you get this on the website, and you look and it's a real head scratcher as to at what point do you think this was needed to be invented. But no, I think the industry is full of so many innovators and so many people keen to push what it is we're doing, that stuff evolves at a decent pace, you know. I think, okay, I know there's a lot of people complain about standards and stuff changing and things like that, but when you meet the engineers behind it, they genuinely, you know, like, they're all bike riders, all really keen just to get everything moving forward in the right direction.
Yeah.
And I guess as long as people aren't too hung up on going, I must have the latest thing in order to enjoy my bike ride, and they're happy to make the most of what they've got, I think there's so much to be said for enjoying your bike and using your bike, or experimenting with setup on your bike and making a few small changes that can really transform your experience on the bike.
Okay.
And I think that's a big part of our job. In aside from the testing bit, you know, obviously in MUK we've always had this really strong how-to section in the mag, and, and done various things over the years with, you know, instructional bits and pieces, and there's so many sort of fundamental things people can just go out and learn, and then there's all these tweaks they can make to their bike before they need to go and shell out thousands and thousands of pounds. And there's kind of circling back to what I said before, you know, there's so many good cheap bikes out. Well, not cheap bikes, but cheaper bikes.
Yeah, comparably.
Yeah. You think about where we started when, you know, technology was awful. Last sprung fork. Yeah. You know? So anytime it got cold, your suspension didn't work. Things like that. Whereas now you've got the likes of the Caliber bikes, you know, that sort of £1,000 price point getting really competitive. We're about to run, I'm just trying to think where we're at now. Has that just gone to print? I think it's just gone to print. So it's a £1,500 full suspension bike test.
Yeah.
And just looking at the specs on those bikes, it's insane how far they've come in just 2 years. I remember doing Bike of the Year a couple of years ago, where we were scratching around for bikes. Some of the bikes didn't even have dropper posts, around sort of £2,000, £2,500, sort of £3,000.
Yeah.
Now you're half that, and half the bike test had dropper posts.
It's impressive, isn't it?
Yeah, and then you go back 5 years before that, and it might have been some of those bikes had mechanical disc brakes. Then 5 years before that, it might have only been one of the bikes with disc brakes.
Yeah.
You know, that's how quick, I guess, it's progressed.
That's cool.
So
yeah.
I think,
and the geometry has changed as well. So, you know, the geometry is trickling down slowly to lower price points. I mean, that's probably what makes the biggest difference.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't, for love nor money, get a bike with a decent wheelbase or head angle 10 years ago, even if you wanted to spend £6,000 on it. But nowadays you can buy a £1,000 or £2,000 bike that has nice geometry. It's got a wide handlebar. It's got a short stem. It's got probably half decent tires. It may have a one-by drivetrain, so you don't have to worry about shifting, and you don't have to worry about chain falling off all the time. Like, these are real improvements, you know, that are easy to notice. That, you know, if you were talking earlier about how, you know, how do we calibrate how we find a bike compared to how our average readers will find it to ride? Well, yeah, if it's got a dropper post, everyone's going to prefer that. If it's got decent tires, if it's got tubeless ready,
yeah,
you know, and that low price point, these things massive differences between the bikes. Like I did a test of some cheap, like £700-ish hardtails. And yeah, some of them had brakes that were borderline dangerous and some of them had brakes that worked really well. Some of them had forks that were one size fits all spring. Some of them had an air spring. So it's not only lighter, but you can adjust the spring rate to suit your weight. Mm-hmm. And they're massive differences.
Yeah.
And that are universal.
And I guess even at the higher end, I think we've seen a shift where, you know, brands would say their bikes enduro ready and yet they come with, you know, the lightest casing tires that might be the harder compound. So you get that sort of initial rush of speed and then before you know it, you've torn an undersidewall and you're like, right, okay, maybe I need to go and buy another set of tires. And, you know, you're seeing brands put much heavier casing tires because, okay, people are going to pick up the bikes in the showroom, in the shop and go, whoa, maybe that's a bit heavy. Is that a bit heavy? But the reality is they don't need to drop another 100 quid on or 120 quid on a set of tires before they roll out the shop. They've got a bike that they can, if they want to, turn up at a race and hammer and it should, you know, survive.
Yeah, you could almost turn up at an EWS on some of these top-end bikes these days.
Yeah.
Like straight out of the factory showroom sort of thing.
Well, and that's what's interesting, the Calibre, that latest bike, that 2 grand Century. I was lucky that I met with Mike, the guy who designed it, and we did some laps around here. And yeah, for a 2 grand bike, you're like, blown away. Really impressive. That's seriously cool. Impressive bike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you guys, we've talked a little bit about the upsides of your jobs, I guess. You get to try all the latest cool product. You get to ride your bike loads. Is it all sunshine and glory? What are the downsides to being a test writer for a magazine?
If Seb goes first, I can get this in his appraisal for next year.
No pressure, Seb.
Just going to make a note.
You get a lot of heat sometimes when you write negative reviews, like we were talking earlier. You've got to deal with that backlash.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of got to get used to it and just sort of deal with it in a mature way. But that's quite hard because, you know, a lot of these people who are, you know, distributing the brand or whatever, you know, you talk to the engineers and, you know, you get on with them and you have a ride with them and it feels really like, you know, like they're your mates.
It's friendly.
And then you give it a negative review and say, I didn't like this and this and this. And then they send an email that's like really hurt and you're like, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, there's thousands of people reading the review that, you know, need to know which way the wind blows.
Yeah.
That's a bit difficult. It's a lot of writing. There's a lot of admin involved.
As with everything.
Yeah. Like bikes don't just turn up ready to be tested. You've got to, you know, there's a bit of turnaround and a bit of admin. A lot of mechanicing.
Yeah.
You've got to do a lot of spannering to kind of set the bikes up and change components and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But don't mind that so much.
What about you, Rob? Are there any bits that you like you could do without?
You know what, like, yeah, in terms of jobs, it's my dream job. So I absolutely love it. And, you know, I've done some pretty crappy jobs over the years and you really appreciate going into a place of work where it's basically like hanging out with your mates, talking about bikes every day. You know, you never think, I never would have been able to go back, you know, I can just imagine going back to my 16-year-old self and going, you know, one day, on a Monday morning, you'll be able to just sit around with the guys and just chat about the World Cup at the weekend, and that's work because someone's going to write something about that, so we kind of need to get some input from everyone, which is fantastic, you know. There's definitely, like Seb touched on, there's definitely some really tough elements of it. You know, a big part, and I think you see it on forums occasionally, that people say, oh, you know, we're paid to do reviews and stuff like that, which is, if anyone had ever seen my car, would know full well we are definitely not paid to do reviews. And I think there's that, yeah, for whatever reason that existed, that there was, you know, the rumors going around and you see it on some forums and stuff like that. But the reality is really quite different. And so I spend quite a lot of my time making sure the guys on the test team don't have to, you know, deal with any pressure from the ads guys, because obviously it might be that a bad review goes out and then the brand would contact us, but they'll also be giving the guys in ads a load of stick and they'll say, oh, you know, we think about pulling ads and stuff like that. And a thing that I was always, you know, from the likes of Steve Wallen back in the day and Danny, the former editor there, and, you know, Tim before him, was, you know, as long as we've done our jobs right, we stick to it. And if they don't advertise, then, you know, that's part of it. And we've probably lost a lot of money over the years
right.
as a result of that.
Yeah.
But equally,
we've kept our integrity, you know, and I think that's really important.
But yeah. equally, like, people pick up MUK still largely because it's full of good reviews and Bike Radar as well. You know, it's not a sexy website. It's not full of World Cup coverage and, you know, great photos of epic features. It's, this is a product. This is what we like about it. This is what we don't like about it. This is what other products there are that might be better or worse. Like, so that without people trusting those reviews, then there's no traffic, and there's no traffic, there's no ad revenue. So I can see where people are coming from. Like Bike Radar is funded by adverts. But increasingly from external, outside the bike industry adverts. But there are bike industry adverts, of course there are, which pays for it, you know? But, you know, that whole cycle would stop if people stopped trusting our reviews.
Yeah. So it's important. Yeah, that's cool.
Definitely. And I think, you know, it's a massive privilege to work on something that I was a massive fan of and still am.
Yeah.
You know, really proud. And, you know, my wife was out last night. I did the load of work and then was reading, you know, one of Seb's reviews. He did a first ride on that new Forbidden bike.
Oh, cool.
You know, I'm still a massive fan, like a big geek. And
yeah.
I want to spend my time doing that. And that's where it gets hard. And I think that's what maybe puts a strain at home sometimes, because it's hard, that separation sometimes is quite awkward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, you know, if sometimes my wife might just see it as going out for a bike ride. When you're like, oh, no,
I'm testing. Work, right?
Testing. And then on the weekend, you're like, I want to go for a ride. My mate's going out for a ride. I'm like, well, weren't you out in the week? I was, yeah, but I was by myself just doing laps on the same track. I want to go out with the guys.
And it's a balance in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. But I wouldn't change it. Yeah, it's cool. Amazing. I mean, I spend a lot of time now, as my job sort of evolved, I do a lot more managing now.
Okay.
And I'm not a trained manager, so that's a really, for me, it's a really steep learning curve. And I think...
How's he doing, Seb?
He's a good man. He's managing.
Just about. I think if you ask anyone that has to deal with a number of people constantly on a day-to-day basis, that becomes really time-consuming and really hard, because you want to do a good job and make sure they enjoy where they work. And you just don't want to have any of those things, any of those little things getting in their way. So you're then trying to deal with the managers above you to make sure that their path is free and easy, that they can kind of do the best job possible and make sure they've got the time to do it. That's the biggest thing.
And that's often invisible to those people because it never gets to them. So they don't always see what you're doing behind the scenes.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, like I said, it's not a bad thing. It's just an element of my job that, okay, it takes me away from the original thing that I kind of got in for it, into it for, which was never going to be a racer. There's no hope of that happening. So what good excuse could I have to ride my bike more? Okay, I'll do this. Great. Okay, I can string a sentence together just about. Brilliant. I'll do that. You know, any excuse to stay out in the woods. And I guess that's the one thing that means that I maybe have got a bit extra admin from, you know. And I'll take it because I still get to come out and ride.
So good. So yeah. So if anyone's listening, they're thinking, "Oh, I want a job like that." What advice would you give to people? Like, what are the kind of key skills? What should people be doing? How do you find your way into this sort of job? Facebook ads.
Don't expect too much money.
Yeah.
Main piece of advice.
Yeah.
And you've got to be. Got to be really into bikes. You got to be really into the nerdiest aspects of bikes, which I am. That's like a big part of why I enjoy it. It's not just about riding it. It's about feeling the differences and getting to ride the latest tech and being really excited about that.
Yeah.
So I think most of all, you've just got to be keen. You've got to be a proper bike nerd, like committed to that geekiness on what makes bikes ride differently.
Uh-huh.
Can't just be sort of semi into that tech side.
Yeah. Do you think a scientific, like an engineering or other science background helps?
I don't know. I guess it could be really relevant. Absolutely. But I also think just hands-on time. You know, I think while my degree probably sounds more applicable, I've got more knowledge just through riding and just being around the scene, I think, more than anything else. Whereas, I think that's really important, you know, and you speak to, it's really interesting, you speak to, you know, shop mechanics and stuff like that, their insights to durability, product durability and stuff like that is so fascinating because of what they see day in, day out, things like that. And then I guess if you're looking to get into it, you know, echoing what Seb said, you know, that passion, and it has to be a passion for detail because, you know, you are trying to just look for, you know, when we're at the end of the month, just before deadline, working late at night, you're just staring at pages, just trying to pick up on these tiny little things, the way in which phrases are written that you want to make sure comes across as concisely and as intended as possible and can't be misconstrued, if that makes sense. And it's that sort of level of detail that we kind of need. And so if you think that's you, then great. And it's a case of then the way I did it, I guess more or less I was lucky that I got in with, you know, like the likes of Andrew Doddy, you know, who's at GMBN now. I was good friends with him, so he was really instrumental in getting me into the office. But then it was just perseverance, really. I decided that, okay, this is something that I really want to get into. And it was, can I do anything? Can I do anything to help? What can I do? You know, whether it's writing a race report, I've just been to a race, can I do that? Or I've got some ideas for features. And it might be when you're a freelancer. I remember I used to send in, you know, 10 ideas and only maybe one would have any kind of traction. And then it's just having that passion, just like yourself with the podcast thing, right? It's you're going above and beyond your normal working hours to fit it all in because you want to get something out of it at the end. And it's just making sure you're trying to do all those little things that add up to something bigger at the end of it. And yeah, I mean, I was just relentless. I think that was the main thing. I probably, you know, just bored them to death. Fine, come in the office, sit down, have a chair. Brilliant.
It worked.
Good stuff. Yeah.
Well, we're getting close to the end of our time, so we'll wrap up with our usual three questions.
Okay.
So let's start with you, Seb. If our listeners had £150 to spend to improve their performance on a bike, where should they invest that money? And it can be bike stuff or it can be off bike, kind of whatever you want.
Surely, if you can get some coaching for 100, it's probably the answer that everyone gives, I imagine.
Not always, but...
But if you can get some coaching for that, then... do that. Every time I go racing, I realize that the bike is not all that counts. You have to be fit and strong and have good technique as well. Coaching
session.
If you can.
There you go. Rob, coaching's got off the table.
Yeah, no, sure. I guess,
take an easy one.
I guess if we're going to go down the component route, I think tires are critical.
Yeah.
And make a huge difference. Absolutely. They can totally transform a bike or they can ruin a bike. Aside from that, I'd say contact points.
Okay.
The right grips.
Yeah.
Pedals, shoes, especially, you know, finding the right combinations.
Yeah. So go on then. Grips, pedals, shoes, tyres. What would you choose?
What specifically?
Would you run if you were running like your own bike? On let's say a dry day somewhere.
So grips, I use probably my go-to at the Santa Cruz Palmdales.
Okay.
So they're relatively thin, they're quite soft rubber.
Yeah.
Those are maybe the Renthor push-on grips, which you have to glue on.
Yeah.
So they're quite forgiving. I think I was saying to you earlier, anything for my old creaky body to make life easier, more comfortable, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
Pedals, I switch from clips to flats all the time.
Okay.
So I run, when I'm clipped in, I normally just run Crank Brother Mallet DH pedals.
Yeah.
And then I guess I change shoes quite a lot, but either I like the Specialized Turfo shoes.
Okay.
Clip version, and then the Gyro Chamber 2s. Flats, Nuke Proof Horizon pedals.
Okay.
And the 510 Impact Pro.
Yes, good shoe.
probably, or the Freerider Pros.
Yeah, tyres?
My go-to, if I'm going to try and stick a set on and leave them for a year, all year round, probably Maxxis Minion DHR2s.
Both front and rear?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't, I'm not really a big fan of semi-slick rear tyres.
Okay.
So I'm so scared. I want to be able to slow down anytime. So I don't like just, because we ride some pretty steep stuff in South Wales, and I just want to be able to pull on the anchors and actually slow down rather than just
get yourself out of trouble.
Skid roughly in the right direction. Yeah. I'd rather just be able to know that I can stop.
Cool. Did you have something else, Seb? You had a you leant forward as if you had a little thought.
Well, going back to what we were saying earlier, if you can get a higher, if your bar height isn't right, get a riser bar that will get it in the right place, because that makes massive difference.
Yeah, and there's a few of those kicking around now. Josh Bryson's got his signature Bergtech, and there's a few other higher bars, isn't there?
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Question two, and we'll start with you this time, Rob. If you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, well, obviously you'd tell him that your job's amazing, but what advice would you give him?
And I'd also say, maybe don't, chill out on the beard, mate. Have a bit more, shave a bit more, it's all right. Too lazy. I guess I'd say probably don't stress out so much. I was a real worrier. Well, I still am a real worrier, but I think get quite anxious about quite a lot of stuff. This in particular, obviously.
But, high pressure.
Yeah, so I think I'd just say, maybe trust in yourself a bit more. It'll be all right. It'll work out.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just, I was really bad at sweating the little things.
Okay.
And maybe not thinking, don't worry, it'll be all right. Because I think a lot of that generally works out.
Yeah.
Where there's a will, there's a way.
Have you found any techniques as you've got older, how to deal with that? How to kind of worry less about the small stuff?
It sounds really simple and really silly, but just trying to be more positive.
Okay.
So I think maybe before, someone, really, really little things, but, when you meet someone and just say, oh, how you doing? And someone says, oh, yeah, I'm all right. Straight away, you're off to sort of a bit of a negative footing, And I guess just little things like that, if I always try and say, actually, I'm really good, because I am, I've got nothing to complain about. I've got a great family, got an amazing job. I absolutely love my life. So, maybe my car's broken down, but it's not the end of the world, because that's happened again. So that's fine. I think just having that, for me at least anyway, just trying to put more of a positive spin on things.
Yeah.
And I think that just gets you into a better place, or it's got me into a better place.
Cool.
And just feeling less anxious about stuff. And
good stuff.
And trying to be nice. I think that's a massively important thing, trying to be nice to people.
Makes your life better, right?
Yeah.
Because you get a good response back generally.
Well, yeah. And I think, I've got a young daughter at home and, just trying to teach you. It's almost like you're teaching yourself, going, don't forget your manners and stuff like that. It's really easy little things that make life way better.
Cool. I like it.
I imagine you were perfectly nice when you were 16. Weren't you?
It's probably more stressed.
Yeah.
Probably, yeah.
We all were. When you're 16, you're pretty grumpy about most things.
Same height, though. I don't think I've grown since I was 12, so that's a bit annoying. But yeah.
Sounds familiar for me.
I just wouldn't stop growing. Really wanted to stop growing.
So what about you, Seb? What advice would you give if you were sat down with 16-year-old Seb?
That's only a couple of years ago,
Last week.
Similar, I was a real worrier. I remember doing downhill races and I couldn't eat. Couldn't eat breakfast before I did a downhill race. Probably because I had such a terrible bike that I was just terrified of going over the handlebars all the time because the bar height was too low. That's taken. Probably to stretch.
Okay.
I've noticed that, I had a bike that snapped and it crashed and hit my shoulder. And then a few weeks later, I thought it was totally unconnected. I started getting knee pain when I was cycling, like lots of cyclists do. So I went to the physio because it's getting worse and worse. And they made the connection with the shoulder injury and said that there's muscles that go diagonally across your back. So if you have a tight shoulder, you're holding your shoulder forwards when you're riding, that'll tighten those muscles across your back, give you a tight glute,
which'll
pull on your IT band, pull your kneecap over. That was his theory anyway.
Okay.
which made me realise, you know, all your muscles are connected. And I realised that if I don't stretch out my glutes and my hamstrings, in particular after riding, I can get a stiff neck, I can get a headache.
Yeah.
I just feel really grumpy. And I find if I stretch, I just feel much better. I'm not sure if it really improves your performance on the bike, but it improves your mood massively, yeah. I think. Because you feel less sort of stressed and tight and achy.
Yeah. So is that a daily practice for you?
No, because, you know, I've got other things to do and you know, you get to like 10 o'clock at night and you're like, oh, I haven't stretched today. I don't want to go to bed, so I go to bed.
But, yeah.
In an ideal world, if you could stretch, and I think I'm so far gone because I've been cycling for so long without stretching. I found that doing a bit of yoga every now and then has almost no effect. But if I really concentrate on those two muscle groups and stretch them really consistently for a good couple of minutes each, not for like 10 seconds of a yoga pose, like 2 minutes or a minute at least, then, you know, it starts to make a difference. And it certainly makes a difference to how I feel in my back in particular.
Okay.
That's like what I would do. Stretching.
We've not really had that before.
If you ride bikes all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Riding bikes is
especially if you ride a bike
good.
And then get in a car for an hour afterwards.
Yeah.
And sit in an office as well.
Yeah. Oh, good answer. All right. And then the last question, we'll start with you, Seb. If you could have a coaching session from anyone, past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn?
Oh, that's interesting. I rode with Fabien Borel once on a canyon launch, and he's really good at explaining to, you know, someone of any level about basic riding technique so I was riding with him and he was kind of giving me little pointers on what I was doing well and what I wasn't doing so well. And he's very like positive and very energetic and really articulate. So possibly with him.
More time with him. Were there any big takeaways from that day? Were there any certain things that you kind of remember and have become ingrained since?
To be honest, there was nothing specific. But going back a little bit towards what Rob said about being nice, just positive feedback as opposed to negative feedback has such a good impact on people. It's a much better way of getting the most out of people.
Yeah.
And I just felt really confident. And I followed him into some of the biggest jumps I've ever done. And it felt great. I just felt really confident after like his feedback on how I was riding, because it was positive based rather than, oh, you're doing this wrong and, oh, you need to do this. And I think when we watch other people ride, it's really common to say, it's really tempting to be like, oh, you're doing this wrong, you're doing that wrong. And I think it's much more productive to focus on what people are doing right and getting them to do more of it rather than focusing on what people are doing wrong and trying to get them to do less of it.
Cool. I like it. Rob, Fabien's off the table.
Yeah. I mean, he's great. He always told me to drop my hips more though. Yeah, stiff back. Stood up too much. Being lazy. That's the problem. Oh, it's a tough one.
So many good riders out there.
Yeah, I mean, Pete would be great because I think he's just makes it all look so easy in the way he carries speed. If there was a way to just tap into that. But I guess maybe part of the reason he's so good at that is because he's so tall. His arms and legs are so big. You know, he can absorb much more stuff. It's a little bit like Seb and I, quite different in terms of height and body shape and the way Seb can suck a jump up, for example. I have to just pull up and jump it because my little legs can't handle it.
Fair play.
But I think Sam Hill would be, prime.
Is there something you'd pick out of his riding that you want to understand? Is there a certain element of what he does?
I guess I was going to say, so Sam Hill and Nico.
Okay.
Because I think both have quite a relaxed style and they're both fairly accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe Sam's more understated, and I don't think people maybe overlook how calculated he probably is, because he really, you know, I remember watching him when we used to be at the bigger races and watching him suss a track out. The way he would practice was always different to everyone else. The way you'd watch him roll down a track really slowly, never really see him pushing that hard and kind of sussing stuff out and spending ages looking at different features and just how he would just have like a different take on how to get through a section that maybe no one else would see. And I guess sometimes you see it with Gwyn, with some of the jumps when he was at around La Bresse.
Oh yeah,
the scrub on that jump.
Yeah.
And similarly, Nico. So, I mean, I rode with Sam. I say I rode with him. I saw him disappear into the distance. We were riding in Italy somewhere, and it was just mind-blowing how easy he made some really, really hard technical things look. Uh-huh. And then with Nico, we were on his practice tracks. It was before, I think they were about to introduce the Spicy with 650B wheels. So we were out riding some of the prototype stuff on some of his test tracks.
Yeah.
And I was with some guys that were good riders, really quick. And you watch them ride a section, and then you watch Nico come in, and you know his body move, barely any body movement, barely moving on the bike. Yet he's just, it's effortless the way he would just float over a section. And you just can't comprehend how he's done it or what he's done. And then he would look at the back of the camera, and it wasn't to say whether it was a good or a bad shot. It was because he wasn't happy with maybe where his knee was, where he was leaning too much or what he was doing. And there was a point where I was on his bike. So we would ride the same size bikes and we were swapping between, they had, at the time it was their first 29er Zesty, I think it was. And it was maybe the second carbon layup they were doing. So it was very sort of early days on that bike, but the Spicy was pretty much there or thereabouts. So I was on his bike and you're riding, you're looking down thinking, what's going on here? And then he sort of explains how he's already on the offset program. You know, he's already changed. He was running a 26 inch wheel offset with a 650B wheel. And we were riding this one really awkward rock section where you had to, as you came in, you would bounce off a rock on the left hand side, transfer over to the right, and then you had to bounce out of it. And it was awkward and it was quite fast, and we were taking pictures on it, which would be fine on, you know, any day normally, but then you've got a 10-time world champ sort of looking over your shoulder, and then he kind of disappeared and I was like, where's Nico gone? And then the photographer was like, right, you need to ride in again, and you just sort of see his head creeping out from behind a rock, and I was like, oh mate, I'm out of control. I might hit you, because I just need to see how the wheel is deforming when we go into this. And I'm like, oh, it's going to be all over the place if I'm riding the bike. But it's just, I guess my point is just that level of that analytical approach he takes, the way he thinks about all that stuff is just, it's incredible. It's all these things that I guess gets you thinking again, okay, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe I need to think more like that. And maybe I need to, you know, look at things differently. And that is utterly fascinating.
Awesome. Very cool experience.
Yeah.
Nice one.
Yeah, I guess it's so hard to answer that question. There's so many good riders, and
yeah, any of them would do. Always good. It's always good to ride with someone different.
Yeah, Brendan, the same. You know, Brendan, Ollie Wilkins, those guys, just the fun they have. You know, that's what we're all in it for, right?
Yeah, yeah, and that translates to speed. If you're enjoying yourself, generally, you end up getting faster. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sorry, cool. I'll give you a really long answer then.
It's all good. No, I like it. Well, we're at the end of our time. So if people want to see more of your work, so obviously the magazine, MBUK.
Yep.
And then is it BikeRadar.com?
Yeah, so BikeRadar.com. We've got MBUK.com as well.
Yeah.
BikeRadar YouTube as well.
Cool. Yeah, okay. Yeah, we'll stick some links in the show notes to all of that so people can find it.
Thank you very much.
Nice one. Well, thanks for a fun day. It's been good to get a bit of a ride in and sit down for a chat. So, yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Nice one. Cheers.
All right, that's it for our chat with Rob and Seb. I hope you've enjoyed listening. Thanks to We Are One Composites and Komoot for supporting this episode. Don't forget they've both got great listener offers for you. Head to komoot.com/G and use the code DOWNTIME, all in uppercase, to get a free regional map bundle of your choice worth $8.99. And in case you're wondering, Komoot is spelled KOMOOT. Head to weareonecomposites.com and use the code DOWNTIME15 at the checkout for 15% off all stock Movement and Revolution Series wheels and their new depackaged bar and stem. Please give us a follow on social media where we're at Downtime Podcast. Subscribe to the show so you get all of the episodes delivered straight to your device. And if you want to get yourself some exclusive Downtime Podcast goodies, then head to downtimepodcast.com/shop. Okay, we'll have another awesome episode coming up for you real soon. But until then, get out and ride.